You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll hear from a fitness specialist who works to help seniors live a healthy and active lifestyle.
First, Election Day is just over a week away. In addition to voting for national and statewide races, voters will also be weighing in on referendums for their local school systems around the state. Many school systems use referendums to raise more money when state education aid drops. So far, 36 districts in the state have passed funding referendums this year, with many more on the ballot next week.
Many rural school districts are turning toward these referendums as they face the problem of lower state education aid along with declining enrollment. Kim Kokel joins us now. He's executive director of the Wisconsin Rural Schools Alliance. Kim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob and Veronica. Appreciate it.
Kim, tell us, first of all, what kind of things are rural school districts in particular looking for in this latest series of referendums?
The majority of them are, you know, operational budgets, and a lot of them, you know, just to keep the doors open and the buildings running and keep staff on hand.
And as I understand it, in the past, usually you'd use a referendum for some special thing, a capital thing, building a new school or something like that. Is it unusual to see this many schools using it just for, as you say, operating expenses?
It's kind of the way budgeting is going right now. I mean, over the last 4 to 5 years, that's the way many of the districts plan their budgeting, just because there's such a shortfall on what the state is providing financially. You know, perfect example, you know, this last year there was right around $122 million put into the budget for education. Unfortunately, with the revenue caps, all that money did not go towards the schools per se, as it went towards property tax relief. So that leaves many of our rural districts, you know, with shortfalls.
Let's talk about that revenue cap issue now. This is a recent change over the last 5 years or so. What does it mean for a school district in practice, the idea of a revenue cap?
Well, really, the revenue caps have been in place since the 90s, and they were actually put in for a short-term response to some stuff that Governor Thompson put in, and they were supposed to sunset like in 96, 97, but that never happened. And so with the revenue caps now, they haven't kept up with inflation. And, you know, so any additional money that districts are getting just goes back for property tax relief, and really isn't, the districts can't use it per se for the things they need in the schools.
And we also mentioned the idea of declining enrollment. Now, this is a rural school problem in particular. How is that affecting districts?
Well, you take the declining enrollment along with high poverty that many of our small rural districts are, you know, find themselves in. It does have some impact on how the funding formula works also, because a lot of those districts are in recreational areas that have high property values. And so you put that high property value, it looks like it's a rich district, but, you know, they have declining enrollment and high poverty. And so in the formula, they look like a rich district, but they really aren't. So they're not getting as much money to help support them as they should.
Talking to Kim Kokel from the Wisconsin Rural Schools Alliance, a lot of areas around the state will see a school referendum on their local ballot, particularly in rural school districts. Talking about some of the particular fiscal challenges for Wisconsin's rural schools. We've heard lately, Kim, about some changes in the way schools can hire and retain teachers, and some rural districts, especially for some teacher specialties, having a hard time competing in the market for teachers. Are you seeing that in a lot of your member districts?
A lot of our member districts are dealing with that. But, you know, overall, you got to look at, there is also a teacher shortage statewide. You know, so when you take that into play, you know, not as many kids going into education that used to go into education, you know, it just makes the market tighter. And, you know, unfortunately, the larger districts, especially in the suburban areas, have the money that they can, for lack of a better term, outbid our rural districts. You know, prior to Act 10, you know, when we were able to give better benefit packages, a lot of rural districts could compete with the suburban schools by offering better, you know, solid benefit packages. But a lot of that was lost after Act 10. So it really kind of swung the playing field on the rural districts.
A lot of schools, as we've said, are trying to deal with these problems via a referendum. A bunch passed earlier this year, more on the ballot next week now. Is this a long-term solution, or is this just a Band-Aid, Kim?
Well, it's a Band-Aid right now. Like I said earlier, it's just how a lot of districts are surviving. Something seriously has to happen at the state level. Either something, an increase in the revenue caps, or the full funding that is needed out there, and making sure every student is worth the same amount. If you look from district to district, kids are looked at differently by where they live, and aren't always worth the same amount, if that makes sense to you, the way the funding formula works right now. And, ideally, some things that could need to happen, like I said, we've got to do something with the revenue cap. One of our recommendations to the governor's office for this upcoming budget is to raise the revenue cap by $200 per student, which would get us caught up somewhat, and not all the way, but will, put us in a better place. But I think, somebody has to take on and really take a serious look at the funding formula that is very outdated and is not meeting the needs of all students in the state of Wisconsin.
Over the years, some people have said we have too many school districts in Wisconsin. There's redundant services, things like that. The answer could be consolidating some of these rural school districts, which would lead to school districts that serve a much wider area. Is that, Kim, something that some schools are considering?
There are districts out there that are considering it. There is a new term that was put in the last budget session. It's called whole grade sharing, and it's been used in Iowa and Minnesota where, some small districts, if they really find that, it might be best to consolidate, instead of forced consolidation, it offers them an opportunity to get together, that District A and District B say, we might be a good fit for each other. You sign a five-year contract, and then you work together over those 5 years to see, is consolidation really going to work for you? And I know there are some districts that have an interest in that piece. The piece that was left out in the last budget cycle was the financial incentive to help with transportation. In Iowa, it's like one-tenth of their student per pupil cost, which is about $630 per student in Iowa. And it really helps offset some of those costs during that five-year period when you're transporting kids to a further district. And I'm sure you've heard about high transportation districts in the state of Wisconsin. We're not fully funded there either. So any additional help with this incentive for the whole grade sharing, I think, would encourage some smaller districts to take a look at, combining.
People have pointed toward a growth in voucher school funding as a problem for schools, and I guess I've heard more about that in urban and maybe suburban areas. Is this an issue for rural schools as well?
Where it really impacts the rural districts, some of our rural districts that are, on the edge of some of the suburban areas that do have voucher schools are impacted, but the majority of our districts don't have voucher students per se, but where they're being impacted is in the state aid formula. Each year, because that piece of the pie is getting smaller and smaller with more students going into the voucher system. And so that makes the piece of the pie for state aid and things like that for our rural public schools, that piece of the pie gets smaller and smaller, is going to get smaller and smaller each year as the voucher program continues to increase. And that's where that real impact is for our rural districts.
Kim, you mentioned a couple changes, revenue cap increases, funding increases from the state. That would have to come from the state legislature and the governor. Do you get the sense that people are listening when you're talking about this? Do they see a sense of urgency facing Wisconsin's rural schools?
I would say yes, there are some that are. I think there are others that don't want to take it on. I would also put out a big shout out to many of our local taxpayers, because they are saying education is important, and that's been proven, with the number of referendums that have been passed in the last couple of years, because they do know the importance of education. And I think it's time for our leaders at the state level to see that education is important, again, in the state of Wisconsin, and, local people are willing to pay some additional taxes to keep quality schools in their districts.
As we wrap up, Kim, what do you wish people outside of the rural parts of Wisconsin knew about the districts you work with?
Our organization, we have 199 members, and out of that 199, 145 are rural school districts. We also have some of the universities and technical colleges as part of our organization, along with 11 of the 12 CSUs. So it's a very wide swath that we cut with our rural groups here, and we continue to grow. We have a state conference coming up next week up in Stevens Point on November 9th and 10th that showcases some of the great things that are going on in our rural schools. We're also going to have a number of speakers there talking about many of the challenges that we're going to be facing right now, and some research that's been done on those. So,
Kim, thanks a lot for joining us today, Kim.
Thank you very much.
That's Kim Kokel, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Rural Schools Alliance. He joined us to talk about challenges facing rural school districts as we see a lot of referendums on the ballot on Election Day.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at efforts to help seniors stay healthy by staying active.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's Executive Producer Erica Janik.
Imagine your spouse doesn't know you anymore. All the moments you shared, gone. Leota Esther tells us about the community that provided the support and stability that both she and her husband needed.
Although I lived in Wisconsin for 40 years, the 2 years that I hold closest to my heart are those that started every day with a walk into Brewster Village. Hidden from Appleton's nearby busy Wisconsin Avenue, but very present to those who've had and have loved ones living there. Once in, I would walk down the hall and greet those in the common room. Further down the hall, there he was, my husband Lee, waiting for me in the Alzheimer's wing. Through the curtains, I could see Lee rise out of his chair to greet me, a huge smile on his face. We'd go to his room, where he might have rearranged the furniture from the day before, where someone else's shirt might be hanging on his rack, and where pictures of his 3 daughters sat on his shelves. When he could still walk, we would go for a ride in the car. On the back roads, we marveled at cows, red barns, old faded signs, and corn high as his knee by the 4th of July. When we drove down the streets in town, he'd occasionally call out, "Hardee's," and point. But other than that, he never talked beyond a single word. Always, when we returned, staff and nurses greeted him, gave him a hug, saw him to the dinner table. This place had become his home, a home that offered the order that Alzheimer patients need, the daily structure of routine, a smooth transition from my love to include those who cared for him. When he had to be in a wheelchair, around the building we went, stopping to smell the one long-lasting white rose, listening to the birds in the not-too-distant trees, and especially singing. It is a gift that those with Alzheimer's can continue to sing the familiar words deep inside them, rising from their depths. Often we wheeled through the halls, where Lee greeted others with a cheerful, "Hi!" Sometimes he'd say, "Hi, Lee!" and we'd all smile. We were all family, healing, recovering, moving slowly to the end of life. I remember Lee's last days, when even then the nurses helped me bundle him up for a ride in the fresh air. When they pushed the piano to the hallway so that everyone in his area with ebbing memories and minds could hear opera tenor Dale Dusing sing to them. I remember, too, when they were by our sides as he died. When folks said, "How sad," as Lee was in the slow process of dying, I could say, "Yes, but it also gave us 2 years of a sweet love affair in a community that provided what we both needed."
Wisconsin Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
A crucial way for seniors to stay healthy is to stay active. And thanks to a senior fitness program in the Madison area, there are more options available.
We spoke with Gina Leary, a fitness specialist for the Goodman Rotary 50 Plus Fitness Program, which is offered through Madison School and Community Recreation. Gina, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So why do you think it's important for people to focus on fitness after the age of 50?
Well, I think it's important for people to focus on fitness pretty much throughout their lives, but for older adults, it also means independence. That's sort of a critical thing as you get a little bit older, and the more fit you are, the more likely you are to enjoy your later years.
I imagine you'll have people showing up, some of whom have been exercising maybe since their high school sporting experience, some who are maybe just taking this on now. Is it important to kind of tailor what people do to how much exercise they've been getting so far, what they're ready for?
Absolutely. And people, as you can imagine, have different things that they want to try. We've got quite a range of classes, and if you can imagine that age group from 50 to 90 or 100, let's say, they all have different needs, and some people go to a lower level gentle exercise class, and some people are in these quite active classes with strength and balance and agility, and it's taught in a big gym with lots of equipment. But everybody has sort of a starting point, you're right, and they need to kind of find out where they fit into the puzzle.
Well, there has been this big cultural push to get Americans more active, and this isn't just for the 50-plus crowd, but have you seen an uptick of interest in that age group?
We have, certainly, and I think a lot of it has to do with the demographics. As you can imagine, there are a lot of older adults, and I think what we really need to do is sort of develop some supportive mechanisms for people to actually do that. So my program is to be supportive in people's efforts to get moving and keep moving, and it could be anything from a walking club or these more active classes, but I think you have to kind of provide for everybody's needs. There's a lot of people with arthritis, so we have arthritis-based classes and instructors who are specially trained to deliver those kinds of classes.
For someone coming in who is just maybe getting exercising for the first time or the first time in a long time, what kind of things should they think about when picking that first exercise program?
Well, we encourage people to come and visit a class. I think you can learn a lot from watching people. I always tell people we're trying to help you, we're not trying to kill you, so come and watch and see what that simple weight training class is all about, and then you can make some decisions about what sorts of things you want to choose to do. But a simple weight training class is a really good starting thing. We do have walking clubs that I think kind of get people moving and socialized a little bit, and then they decide, oh, maybe I can move into something a little bit different. We have stretch and strength classes where you're not doing a lot of moving, but you are getting stronger and more flexible as you go.
We're talking with Gina Leary right now, fitness specialist for the Goodman Rotary 50 Plus Fitness Program, talking about staying active after the age of 50. And Gene, what would you say to people who might be kind of intimidated about taking some of these classes? They're worried maybe that they're going to be the one person in the class who's out of shape, or that the instructor is going to be super buff with six-pack abs and they won't be able to keep up. So what do you tell people like that who just have some concerns?
Well, again, to come and watch the class, I think, is an important piece of that. And also, I always tell people we've got people that are 90-plus years old doing yoga. And I think you kind of have to see that to believe it. But, again, everybody has a starting point, and it might be something as simple as a gentle exercise class where there's always chairs available. You can make some decisions based on what sort of class you want to choose based on the class descriptions. We've got quite a wide variety of those. And I think people really just coming to watch the class for the first time is real important. And we sometimes have free classes when we start the session so that people can try it out.
The medical community in Wisconsin and beyond has been focusing a lot on preventing falls among seniors because that can lead to broken bones and a lot of negative health consequences. What kind of exercise programs are there that might help with fall prevention?
I'm actually on the Dane County Falls Prevention Task Force. It's a really big problem in Wisconsin for a lot of different reasons, and exercise is one of the components that can really help. So in the popular press, you'll see things about Tai Chi, just getting a little bit stronger in your lower body, and then practicing very specific balance exercises that we know from the evidence base that are actually good for people that should be in their sort of day-to-day program. So we have a wonderful class called Balancing Act. We've got one called Core and Balance Combo. A lot of the strength exercises are aimed specifically at working on strength one leg at a time, trying to get people just really a little more functional.
And do you think that that's a good place to start with some of those balance classes if you do only one class? Would you recommend that?
I would actually recommend a strength training class for starters. As odd as it sounds and as intimidating as that might sound, a simple stretch and strength class really goes a long way for you to sort of uncover what those deficiencies are. And it lets an instructor kind of see, well, where can I start with this person? These are all group fitness classes, so it's a little hard initially to get everybody into the right mix, but we have a class called Simple Strength and Gentle Exercise, and those are sort of meant as starter classes for people that are just starting out.
Well, Jean, thank you so much for talking today.
Sure, you're welcome.
Jean O'Leary is a fitness specialist for the Goodman Rotary 50 Plus Fitness Program in Madison, and we've been talking about programs to help seniors stay active and healthy.
Coming up, a new study reports that Minnesota is beating Wisconsin when it comes to health outcomes. We'll find out why we're lagging behind and why it matters. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's Reveal. On TV, the justice system usually works like clockwork. Everybody gets their lawyer, the crime is solved in a neat and timely way, and of course, justice is served. But in real life, it doesn't always work out that way. On this Reveal, we take a look at the cracks in the system that prevent people from getting a fair shake. Excuse me. That's coming up tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, Wisconsin and Minnesota are natural rivals. We share a border and we battle on the football field. But a new study published in the Wisconsin Medical Journal suggests that Minnesotans are healthier than Wisconsinites.
The study found that Wisconsinites had higher rates of unhealthy behaviors like smoking, physical inactivity, and drunk driving-related deaths.
Joining us now is one of the researchers on the project. Dr. Patrick Remington is a professor and associate dean in the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Patrick, welcome back.
Good to be back. Thanks.
So overall, how does Wisconsin look compared to Minnesota?
Well, we took the opportunity to use our county health rankings to compare Wisconsin's 72 counties to Minnesota's 87 counties. And when you look at the two-state region overall, Minnesota has a lower what we call premature death rate, years of life lost before the age of 75, than Wisconsin, about 15% better. And if you totaled up all those lost years, it'd be about 45,000 extra years of life that people in Minnesota enjoy compared to Wisconsin.
Well, that's an interesting take. So big picture, why is that? What's going on?
Well, when we break it down, we have five outcome measures that we compared, and Minnesota's better than Wisconsin in all of them, not just the length of life, but in measures of quality of life and also measures of early life, the rates of low birth weight. We also looked at things we call health factors or health determinants, things that affect people's length and quality of life. And of those 28 measures, Minnesota ranked better in 23 of them. Wisconsin was better in only five. So the, in fact, notably, Wisconsin was better in all nine of the health behavior measures and seven of the eight social and economic factors. So the, in a way, the deck is stacked against Wisconsin. It's harder to get good health outcomes. It's harder for Wisconsinites to live long and healthy lives, given those disadvantage in those risk factors.
Did any of this surprise you, Patrick? I mean, you look at two states, northern Midwestern states. I can't imagine the populations of Wisconsin and Minnesota are too terribly different. So would you have expected more parity between the two?
Well, I've been following this for about 25 years since I worked at the state health department. And we have known for years that Minnesota and Wisconsin were some of the healthier states in the nation. But what's happened is that Wisconsin's health ranking nationally has slowly declined from the top 10 as high as fourth best in the nation. Now our rank is 24th. We're right in the middle of the nation. Minnesota's kept its ranking up relative to the other states. So it is something that's developed over the years. We have not been as successful in providing good health outcomes as Minnesota has.
So Wisconsin has a portrait you're painting is Wisconsin really slipping over the years. So what do you think is happening in Wisconsin that's not happening in Minnesota?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer because there's not one factor that's associated with it. We did some statistical analyses to figure out if we leveled the playing field on the rates of unemployment and children living in poverty and smoking rates and other factors, then in effect the health of Wisconsin would be about the same as the health in Minnesota. So we really know that it's not a single factor, but it's the constellation of these factors. So what's obviously happening is Minnesota's maintained a healthier environment, both economic environment, education, health care, healthy behaviors compared to Wisconsin over the last 20 years.
We're talking with Dr. Patrick Remington right now. He's a professor and associate dean at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, also a member of the Wisconsin Medical Society's Board of Directors. And we're looking at how Wisconsin stacks up health-wise compared to Minnesota. And the answer is our neighbors to the west are doing better. They're cumulatively living longer lives thanks to healthy behaviors and other factors that go into that. And let's pull this apart a little bit, Dr. Remington. What do you think about one of these five measures you look at? Let's say physical environment first. Is there something there that stands out to you?
Well, that's the factor where we are closest with Minnesota. We use five different measures to measure the physical environment, things like air pollution, drinking water problems, measures of housing problems, and issues related to commuting to work. Minnesota rates slightly better in three of these, and Wisconsin rates better in having less air pollution and less people who have long commutes to work. But basically, if you think about the physical environment, when you drive across the border between Wisconsin and Minnesota, you don't notice much of a change in the built or physical environment, and that's reflected in our data.
And how about those health behaviors you were talking about?
Well, there you see pretty dramatic differences. Again, looking at smoking, obesity, the food environment, physical inactivity, excessive drinking, teen births, sexually transmitted diseases, all nine of these measures, Minnesota ranks better than Wisconsin. Again, some of these differences are not significant, but rates of STDs, for example, Minnesota is only 316, Wisconsin it's 430. So some of the differences are quite significant.
And when you look at one of those that you just talked about, excessive drinking, rather, this is when Wisconsin, we know, struggles with a drinking culture and excessive drinking. How does that in particular compare to Minnesota, and how much impact do you think it has?
Well, all of these contribute to increased risk of early death. Excessive drinking is a good example, drinking and driving or binge drinking. Wisconsin, unfortunately, since surveys were begun in the mid-80s, has led the nation in rates of binge drinking and driving. We, in this report, see that to be 24% in Wisconsin, as high as 36%. That's more than a third of adults reporting that they drink excessively, compared to Minnesota, which is about 19%. Again, there's a range in the Minnesota counties, but it's not that 19% is good. That's clearly higher than it should be, but it's better than it is in Wisconsin. And so we've got some work to do even to catch up to Minnesota, but even more work to get to the point where we would want to be with a public health goal.
We hear a lot on this show and in other places about what can be a shortage of care providers in rural areas of Wisconsin. Do you see that as being part of the picture here when it comes to access to care, your clinical care section?
Well, that's interesting because of the 7 measures we use to compare clinical care, Wisconsin actually fares slightly better in measures of quality, diabetic screening and mammography screening rates. But as you mentioned, our measure of access to primary care physicians, dentists, and mental health providers, Minnesota scores quite a bit better across those 3 measures. So clearly you want high-quality care, you want people to have insurance, but you have to have providers to be in each community so that people can actually have access to care. And we're not doing as well as Minnesota, and both states are not where they should be.
And looking at the factors of education, what do you see there when you look at Wisconsin versus Minnesota?
Well, again, of these 9 social and economic factors, it turns out that these factors are fundamental to good health. They not only lead to healthier behaviors and better access to high-quality health care, but they themselves can directly affect an individual's health. And except for high school graduation rates, where we are ahead of Minnesota, we have lower rates of people who have attained a college degree and higher rates of children living in poverty, rates of unemployment, and violent crime rates. Minnesota beats us on all those other factors. So this is really a challenge for us to think about the social and economic policies that can improve rates of employment, that can reduce children living in poverty. Those are the things that really can be changed to move these factors that affect health downstream.
We're talking with Dr. Patrick Remington. He's the author of a report that shows that Minnesota is doing much better than Wisconsin when it comes to health. Dr. Remington is a professor and associate dean in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and is a member of the Wisconsin Medical Society's Board of Directors.
And you can join in now at 800-642-1234. Put a face on this discussion. Let us know what's happening in your community. What do you see as some of the biggest health concerns or opportunities for improvement where you live? What do you think about smoking rates and anti-smoking efforts, alcohol culture in Wisconsin, efforts to turn that around? What would make a difference in making Wisconsin a healthier place? And if you work in healthcare or public health, love to know what's going on in your part of the state. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll be back in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation with Dr. Patrick Remington about how Minnesota does better than Wisconsin when it comes to health outcomes.
New report compares Minnesota and Wisconsin side by side on a lot of issues, environment, education, socioeconomic issues, but also health behavior, smoking, alcohol, drunk driving. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What is the biggest health issue in your community? What could be done about it? What needs to be done about it? What questions do you have for Dr. Remington about this report and about our overall health here in Wisconsin? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Mike joining us in Lake Mills. Mike, hi.
Good afternoon.
What did you want to add?
I wonder if the docs could comment, if you compare the same socioeconomic strata in Minnesota and Wisconsin, if the differences extend across there? In other words, are they the same if Wisconsin from one group to Minnesota, or is there a difference?
Mike, thanks for that. Dr. Remington?
Well, that's a good question. So, in other words, we know that the social and economic factors are better in Minnesota compared to Wisconsin. So what would happen if we leveled that playing field, if we compared social counties with the same social and economic factors? And what we find is that Minnesota still fares better because they have better behaviors, better health behaviors, even within those same social strata. However, when you control for social and economic factors and the behaviors and level that playing field and said, is Minnesota or Wisconsin any different, those differences go away. Another way to think about it is that we can explain the differences in the length and quality of life of the two states by those factors, by the differences in social economic factors and in the health behaviors. But predominantly, most of that is rooted in the differences in our social and economic factors.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. And we're going to go next to Virginia joining us in Milwaukee. Hi, Virginia.
Hello. Thank you. I have a question for Dr. Remington. I wondered if your study looks at the differences in spending on parks and recreation. I know that in Minneapolis is ranked the first in the nation in terms of parks, and also they have kind of a net regional and statewide support of all parks. But also in Wisconsin, we've kind of defunded our state parks.
Mm-hmm. Interesting question, Virginia. What about the way that public spaces, access to parks, and support of those spaces plays out?
Well, this is the difference between looking at what the data show, and the data don't lie. There are definite measurable differences in both the health outcomes and these factors. What we can then do is hypothesize that differences in policies might be driving these differences, for example, in physical activity or obesity rates. And certainly we know there's evidence to say that the more you invest in healthy communities, the more you invest in green space and mixed-use transportation policies. But also, even beyond that, the more you invest in education, in local public health, all of these societal interventions and investments yield return. These healthy community policies lead to healthier people and then a better health outcome. So I can't point to a single policy, but it's the sum of all those policies that has led over the last 25 years to differences in the health outcomes between Minnesota and Wisconsin, most certainly.
Virginia, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate that. And next, we're going to go to John in Madison. Hi, John.
Hi. I had a question about quality of health care, if there's any studies or your study included the quality of the health care delivered to the patient. The reason is my wife and I moved to Madison from the Twin Cities about a year and a half ago. And even though I think our health care coverage is better now, we're finding that the quality of the health care we receive is much worse than Wisconsin, meaning it's harder to get to a doctor. It's harder to get to a doctor right away. The doctors we have seen have been not very good. And even in my personal experience, I can't speak for everyone, I'm finding that the mannerisms of the doctors I've dealt with down in Wisconsin here are much worse. I'm just wondering if you can comment on that.
John, thank you for that. And Dr. Remington, that's an interesting one. He's kind of talking about two different things there, but certainly in terms of access, it's harder to get in to see people. How do you control for the quality of the medical care?
Well, we use about 35 measures that are part of the county health rankings. This is a program that comes out of the University of Wisconsin and is actually a nationwide program. And the good thing is because these measures are available in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and every other state in the nation, we can make these comparisons. But to really answer the caller's question, you'd have to dig down deeper into the measures of healthcare quality. And as he points out, not just between the two states, but between health systems. And those quality measures are available. The Wisconsin Hospital Association and Wisconsin Collaborative for Healthcare Quality are putting measures up for the public to see to compare health systems and to compare quality. Our actual measures, the two that we use for diabetic screening rates and mammography screening rates show the Minnesota and Wisconsin are very comparable, but that's not the level of resolution that the caller is speaking of. That he's speaking of a specific provider or a specific health system or health plan, and for that, you should go to other sources and dig a little deeper.
And do you think if you did find some striking differences, that could be part of this picture?
Well, actually, I think, you know, based on this overall analysis, we don't see striking differences between the quality of health care and between the two states. I think the most important drivers, at least in our study, are the difference in social and economic factors and lifestyle factors, health behaviors. But I think both states have relatively high rates of insurance compared to the rest of the nation and relatively good quality of care and not great differences between the two states.
We're talking with the UW's Patrick Remington, looking at a new report showing that when it comes to good health outcomes, Wisconsin falls behind Minnesota, our neighbor to the west. And we'll take another call now at 800-642-1234. And Shelley is with us now in Milwaukee. Shelley, hi.
Hi there. I have a question. When you pulled out looking at health, if you teased out the mental health and the ease of access between the two states. Thank you. I'll listen to the answer on the air.
Thanks, Shelley. Dr. Remington?
Well, that's a great question. We have very preliminary measures of mental health. One question is asked of individuals, how many days in the last 30 days has your mental health not been good? And the number in Wisconsin, about 3 days on average, is more than the number in Minnesota, which is about 2.5 days. So people in Wisconsin are reporting slightly more problems with poor mental health. But with respect to mental health providers, Minnesota has about 750 people for every mental health provider. In Wisconsin, it's more than 1,000. So there's a significant difference in the availability of mental health providers and probably not surprisingly in the self-reported mental health that people report.
Thanks for that call. And next we go to Sandra in Lake Geneva. Hi, Sandra.
Hello.
What did you want
to... My question regards the quality of health care and the length of time getting in also. And I would like to just tell my own briefly. It's harder over the last, I don't know how many years, to get into a doctor. It's not uncommon for me to hear 8 weeks, 10 weeks. They don't get called back for appointments. And now that I'm in general health care, that's coinciding with what I've had. Also, the quality of care regarding elder people. I don't know how the ratio is for that, but I've noticed now that I fall into that category.
Sandra, thank you. I just want to make sure we get our guest in on this. So what about the picture that Sandra's painting there? It's harder for an older Wisconsinite, the different kind of quality there that she's seeing, hard to get in.
Yeah, it's hard to measure access, and I think it's important, first of all, for individuals who are having problems with their own health care, you can certainly follow up with your health insurance company or your providers. But when we look across the state, getting an appointment and how long it takes isn't the most important. It's an important part of health care, but you have to have high quality. You have to have health care providers accessible, but also high quality of health care once you see a physician. But that varies not only between states, but between different provider groups. And these days, we ask people to shop around, really, to find the best care that you can in your community.
And we leave it there. Dr. Remington, appreciate you joining us today.
It's good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
We were speaking there with Dr. Patrick Remington. He's a professor and associate dean in the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, also a member of the Wisconsin Medical Society's Board of Directors. And he joined us there to talk about his new research that shows Minnesota is outdoing Wisconsin in terms of health outcomes and looking at what may be going on there and what we could change. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.